I'm Cheryl Corley, and this is News and Notes. Earlier in the program, we spoke with Sheila Holt Orsted, who claims the cancer she and her family have battled are the result of toxic chemicals dumped in her mostly African-American neighborhood in Tennessee. It's been 20 years since a landmark report helped invigorate the movement against this kind of environmental racism. That report was called Toxic Waste and Race in the United States. And now a new follow-up report finds little progress has been made to protect communities of color. I spoke with two of the new report's authors, Robert Bullard, director of the Environmental Justice Resource Center at Clark Atlanta University, and Paul Mohai, professor of natural resources and the environment at the University of Michigan. Bullard says environmental racism is as big a problem as it's ever been.
African Americans, Latino Americans, Native Americans, and Pacific Islanders make up the vast majority of residents living near commercial waste sites. That number is about 56%. And if you look at the number of people who live near facilities that are clustered, that is, once you get one, you get two, you get three, those numbers increase dramatically.
Mm-hmm. Has the government response over these past 20 years been any quicker when you find problems in communities of color with dump sites and toxic waste? Mr. Mohai, why don't we throw that one to you?
The 1987 report and some subsequent events eventually got this issue onto EPA's policy agenda, and they did several things that got other parts of government going, including coming out with its own report in 1992, where they reviewed the data and developed some initial policy recommendations. And even though that report was heavily criticized at the time for not going far enough, it nevertheless was very significant because it was the first official acknowledgement that environmental injustices and disparities exist. However, since the events of the early 90s and mid-90s, we've seen a real slowdown in terms of the effort that the government is making. In fact, disparities are not only continue to exist, but they seem in many respects even more grave than they were 20 years ago.
So have the obstacles to progress changed? I mean, you talk about how some things are being rolled back. What kind of obstacles did we see 20 years ago, and what kind of obstacles are we facing now?
We're seeing, in the last 6 years, seeing a tremendous pushback and attack on environmental justice. For example, the executive order that was signed by President Clinton in 1994, there was an attempt in 2006 to basically gut that order by taking race out of the order. If you take race and income out of that executive order and not do targeted enforcement, then you basically don't have an order. There's an attempt to roll back the toxic release inventory database, where you can have the industry reporting what's coming out, how much is coming out of these factories in terms of dangerous chemicals, to make that ineffectual. In 2001, the U.S. Supreme Court made it very difficult to prove environmental discrimination by making the reasons to show it, to prove it, you have to show intent. There have been a number of strategies to look the other way, not to enforce, and to really allow industry to get away, and many people would say, with murder.
And you feel that strongly about it?
If you look at the facts and the situation and the circumstances, and we dealt with that in the report, in addition to dealing with statistical data and quantitative analysis, we also have case studies. One of the case studies deals with Dixon, Tennessee.
We spoke earlier with Sheila Holt Orsted.
Exactly, and that's a classic example of environmental racism. I've written, you know, a dozen books on the topic. The other case is in Louisiana, post-Katrina cleanup, or lack thereof, and looking at the fact that in many African-American communities in New Orleans, the federal government is basically saying, well, there's contamination, but the contamination that's there in New Orleans today was there before the storm, and therefore we don't have to clean it up. That is unacceptable. The mere fact that there were communities fighting to get cleaned up in New Orleans, the Agricultural Street landfill community, before Katrina. And that community basically was fighting to get relocated, and they were relocated in August of 2005, not by the government, not by some policy, but by a terrific storm that tore through that area.
It seems kind of incredulous that there are these laws in place over this past 20 years, there's been a lot of focus on environmental justice, and now we seem to be at a period where that focus isn't there. Is that why these laws just aren't working?
Laws themselves are really just, in effect, no more forceful or worth any more than the paper they're written on unless people put effort in enforcing them. But even when the laws are enforced, they don't seem to be enforced equally vigorously across the board. If they were, I suspect we certainly would have a diminishment of the problem, but maybe we would have no problem at all.
Robert Bullard is director of the Environmental Justice Resource Center at Clark Atlanta University, and Paul Mohai teaches in the School of Natural Resources and the Environment at the University of Michigan. Thank you both gentlemen for joining us.
Thank you.